Chapter 6. We had come down to the Rift Valley by the sandy red road across a high plateau, then up and down through the orchard-bushed hills, around a slope of forest to the top of the rift wall, where we could look down and see the plain, the heavy forest below the wall, and the long, dried-up edge shine of Lake Manyara rose-colored at one end with 500,000 tiny dots that were flamingos. From there, the road dropped steeply along the face of the wall, down into the forest, onto the flatness of the valley, through cultivated patches of green corn, bananas, and trees I did not know the names of, walled thick with forest, past a Hindu's trading store and many huts, over two bridges where clear, fast-flowing streams ran, through more forest, thinning now to open glades, and into a dusty turnoff that led into a deeply rutted, dust-filled track through bushes to the shade of Mutu Umbo camp. That night, after dinner, we heard the flamingos flighting in the dark. It was like the sound the wings of ducks make as they go over before it is light, but slower, with a steady beat, and multiplied 1,000 times. Pop and I were a little drunk, and POM was very tired. Carl was gloomy again. We had taken the edge from his victory over Rhino, and now that was past anyway, and he was facing possible defeat by Oryx. Then, too, they had found not a leopard but a marvelous lion, a huge black-maned lion that did not want to leave, on the rhino carcass when they had gone there the next morning, and could not shoot him because he was in some sort of forest reserve. "That's rotten," I said, and tried to feel bad about it, but I was still feeling much too good to appreciate anyone else's gloom, and Pop and I sat, tired through to our bones, drinking whiskey and soda and talking. The next day we hunted Oryx in the dried-up dustiness of the Rift Valley, and finally found a herd way off at the edge of the wooded hills on the far side above a Maasai village. They were like a bunch of Maasai donkeys, except for the beautiful straight slanting black horns, and all the heads looked good. When you look closely, two or three were obviously better than the others, and sitting on the ground, I picked what I thought was the very best of the lot, and as they strung out, I made sure of this one. I heard the bullets smack and watched the oryx circle out away from the others, the circle quickening, and I knew I had it. So I did not shoot again. This was the one Carl had picked, too. I did not know that, but had shot deliberately, selfish, to make sure the best this time at least, but he got another good one, and they went off in a wind-lifted cloud of gray dust as they galloped. Except for the miracle of their horns, there was no more excitement in shooting them than if they had been donkeys, and after the truck came up and Imkola and Chara had skinned the heads out and cut up the meat, we rode home in the blowing dust, our faces gray with it, and the valley one long heat mirage. We stayed at that camp 2 days. We had to get some zebra hides that we had promised friends at home, and it needed time for the skinner to handle them properly. Getting the zebra was no fun. The plain was dull, now that the grass had dried hot and dusty after the hills, and the picture that remains is of sitting against an anthill with, in the distance, a herd of zebra galloping in the gray heat haze, raising a dust, and on the yellow plain, the birds circling over a white patch there, another beyond, there a third, and looking back, the plume of dust of the truck coming with the skinners and the men to cut up the meat for the village. I did some bad shooting in the heat on a Grant's gazelle that the volunteer skinners asked me to kill them for meat, wounding him in a running shot after missing him 3 or 4 times, and then following him across the plain until almost noon in that heat, until I got within range and killed him. But that afternoon we went out along the road that ran through the settlement and passed the corner of the Hindu's general store, where he smiled at us in a well-oiled, unsuccessful storekeeping, brotherly humanity, and hopeful salesmanship, turned the car off to the left onto a track that went into the deep forest, a narrow, brush-bordered track through the heavy timber that crossed a stream on an unsound log and pole bridge and went on until the timber thinned and we came out into a grassy savanna that stretched ahead to the reed-edged, dried-up bed of the lake with far beyond the shine of water and the rose pink of the flamingos. There were some grass huts of fishermen in the shade of the last trees, and ahead the wind blew across the grass of the savanna, and the dried bed of the lake showed a white gray with many small animals humping across its baked surface as our car alarmed them. They were reed buck, and they looked strange and awkward as they moved in the distance, but trim and graceful as you saw them standing close. We turned the car out through the thick, short grass and onto the dried lake floor, and everywhere, to the left and to the right, where streams flowed out into the lake and made a reedy marsh that ran down toward the receded lake, cut by canals of water. Ducks were flying, and we could see big flocks of geese, spread over the grassy hummocks that rose above the marsh. The dried bed was hard and firm, and we drove the car until it commenced to look moist and soft ahead, then left the motor car standing there, and Carl taking Charo and I, Imkola to carry shells and birds, we agreed to work one on one side and one the other of the marsh, and try to shoot and keep the birds moving while Pop and POM went into the edge of the high reeds on the left shore of the lake, where another stream made a thick marsh to which we thought the ducks might fly. We saw them walk across the open, a big, bulky figure in a faded corduroy coat and a very small one in trousers, gray khaki jacket, boots, and a big hat, and then disappear as they crouched in a point of dry reeds before we started. But as we went out to reach the edge of the stream, we soon saw the plan was no good. Even watching carefully for the firmest footing, you sunk down in the cool mud to the knees, and as it became less mucky, there were more hummocks broken by water. Sometimes I went into the waist. The ducks and geese flew up out of range, and after the first flock had swung towards where the others were hidden in the reeds, we'd heard the sharp, small, double report of POM's 28 gauge and saw the ducks wheel off and go out toward the lake. The others scattered flocks, and the geese all went out toward the open water. A flock of dark ibises, looking with their dipped bills like great curlews, flew over from the marsh on the side of the stream where Carl was and circled high above us before they went back into the reeds. All through the bog were snipe and black and white godwits, and finally, not being able to get within range of the ducks, I began to shoot snipe to Imkola's great disgust. We followed the marsh out, and then I crossed another stream, shoulder high, holding my gun and shooting coat with shells in the pocket above my head, and finally trying to work toward where POM and Pop were, found a deep, flowing stream where teal were flying, and killed three. It was nearly dark now, and I found Pop and POM on the far bank of the stream at the edge of the dried lake bed. It all looked too deep to wade, and the bottom was soft, but finally I found a heavily worn hippo trail that went in the stream and treaded on this, the bottom fairly firm underfoot. I made it, the water coming just under my armpits. As I came out on the grass and stood dripping, a flock of teal came over very fast, and crouching to shoot in the dusk, at the same time Pop did, we cut down three that fell hard in a long slant ahead in the tall grass. We hunted carefully and found them all. Their speed had carried them much further than we expected, and then, almost dark now, we started for the car across the gray, dried mud of the lake bed, me soaked and my boots squishing water, POM pleased with the ducks, the first we'd had since the Serengeti. We all remembered how marvelous they were to eat, and ahead we could see the car looking very small, and beyond it a stretch of flat, baked mud, and then the grassy savanna and the forest. Next day we came in from the zebra business, gray and sweat-caked with the dust that the car raised, and the wind blew over us on the way home across the plain. POM and Pop had not gone out. There was nothing for them to do, and no need for them to eat that dust. And Carl and I out on the plain in the too much sun and dust had gone through one of those rows that starts like this. What was the matter?
They were too far.
Not at the start.
They were too far, I tell you.
They get hard if you don't take them.
You shoot them.
I've got enough. I only want 12 hides altogether. You go ahead. Then someone, angry, shooting too fast to show he was being asked to shoot too fast, getting up from behind the anthill and turning away in disgust, walking towards his partner who says smugly, "What's the matter with them?"
"They're too damn far, I tell you."
Desperately. The smug one complacently. "Look at them." The zebra that had galloped off had seen the approaching truck of the Skinners and had circled and were standing now, broadside, in easy range. The one looks, says nothing, too angry now to shoot, then says,
"Go ahead, shoot."
The smug one, more righteous now than ever, refuses. "Go ahead," he says.
"I'm through," says the other.
He knows he's too angry to shoot, and he feels he's been tricked. Something is always tricking him, the need to do things other than in a regular order, or by an inexact command in which details are not specified, or to have to do it in front of people, or to be hurried. "We've got 11, says smug face, sorry now. He knows he should not hurry him, that he should leave him alone, that he only upsets him by trying to speed him up, that he has been a smugly righteous bastard again. "We can pick up the other one any time. Come on, Bo, we'll go."
"No, let's get him. You get him."
"No, let's go in." And as the car comes up and you ride in through the dust, the bitterness goes and there's only the feeling of shortness of time again. "What you thinking about now?" you ask. "What a son of a bitch I am still?"
About this afternoon, he says and grins, making wrinkles in the cake dust on his face. Me too, you say. Finally, the afternoon comes, and you start. This time, you wear canvas ankle-high boots, light to pull out when you sink. You work out from hummock to hummock, picking away across the marsh and wade and flounder through the canals and the duck's flies before out to the lake. But you make a long circle to the right and come out into the lake itself and find the bottom hard and firm, and walking knee-deep in the water, get outside the big flocks. Then there is a shot, and you and Imkola crouch, heads bent, and then the air is full of them, and you cut down two, then two again, and then a high one straight overhead, then miss a fast one straight and low to the right. Then they come whistling back, passing faster than you can load and shoot. You brown a bunch to get cripples for decoys, and then take only fancy shots, because you know now you can get all that we can use or carry. You try the high one, straight overhead and almost leaning backward, the coup de roi, and splash a big black duck down beside Imkola, him laughing, then the four cripples swimming away. You decide you better kill them and pick up. You have to run in water to your knees to get in range of the last cripple, and you slip and go face down and are sitting, enjoying being completely wet, finally, water cool on your behind, soaked with muddy water, wiping off glasses, and then getting the water out of the gun, wondering if you can still shoot up the shells before they will swell. Imkola, delighted with the spill. He, with the shooting coat now full of ducks, crouches, and a flock of geese pass over in easy range while you try to pump a wet shell in. You get a shell in, shoot, but it's too far, or you are behind. And at the shot, you see a cloud of flamingos rise in the sun, making the whole horizon of the lake pink. Then they settle. But after that, each time you shoot, you turn and look out into the sun on the water and see the quick rise of the unbelievable cloud, and then the slow settling. Kola, you say and point. Indio, he says, watching them. Missouri,
and hands you more shells. We all had good shooting. But it was best out on the lake, and for 3 days afterward traveling, we had cold teal, the best of ducks to eat, fine, plump, and tender, cold with panyan pickles, and the red wine we bought at Babati, sitting by the road waiting for the trucks to come up, sitting on the shady porch of the little hotel at Babati. Then, late at night, when the trucks finally came in and we were at the house of an absent friend of a friend, high up in the hills, cold at night, wearing coats at the table, having waited so long for the broken-down truck to come that we all drank much too much and were unspeakably hungry. POM dancing with the manager of the coffee shamba and with Carl to the gramophone. Me shot full of emmetine and with a ringing headache drowning it successfully with a whiskey soda with Pop on the porch, it dark and the wind blowing a gale, and then those teal coming on the table, smoking hot and with fresh vegetables. Guinea hen were all right, and I had one now in a lunchbox in the back of the car that I would eat tonight. But those teal were the finest of all. From Babati, we had driven through the hills to the edge of a plain, wooded in a long stretch of glade, beyond a small village, where there was a mission station at the foot of a mountain. Here, we had made a camp to hunt kudu, which was supposed to be in the wooded hills and in the forest on the flats that stretched out to the edge of the open plain.